I just want a Gen X president to bring this back to generational.
Do you feel left out as a Gen Xer?
I mean, I think this is actually like literally. Oh my God. This is like part of the appeal of Beto. He's so Gen X-y.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Galen Druk. I hope everyone had a good Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It's only been 3 days since you heard from us, but the field of Democratic contenders for the presidency has grown again, which means I think that it is time for some music.
Only 16 more times, audience, roughly speaking, we have to hear that as more and more candidates declare.
And that means that California Senator Kamala Harris is running for president. She was elected to the Senate in 2016 and was the Attorney General of California before that. And here with me to talk about what her path to the nomination could look like are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going?
It's going well. Thank you.
Senior politics writer Clem Malone. How are you?
Hey, Galen.
And with us is senior writer Perry Bacon Jr. Good to have you, Perry. How's it going?
Good to be here with you guys.
And Micah Cohen is out today. Also today, we're going to talk about capitalism and how the left feels about it. Claire spent a bunch of time talking to activists on the left to understand what they want and how they're trying to get it. But before we get to any of that, let's talk about the BuzzFeed report. So on Friday, we recorded an emergency podcast discussing BuzzFeed's report that, quote, President Donald Trump directed his longtime attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about negotiations to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. Since that emergency podcast, special counsel Robert Mueller's office released a statement saying, quote, BuzzFeed's description of specific statements to the special counsel's office and characterization of documents and testimony obtained by this office regarding Michael Cohen's congressional testimony are not accurate. Claire and Perry, you weren't on Friday's podcast, but I'm sure you've seen the reporting. And Nate, you were here, so let's begin with you. How much does the statement from Mueller's office change what we said on Friday?
So it changes it a lot, I think, first of all, because the special counsel's office is notoriously silent about stuff. And there have been lots of Russia stories where there were significant, potentially significant inaccuracies that they did not comment on. You know, so the fact that they kind of drop in with this comment that is, in their style, like a little bit ambiguous. I mean, the threshold for commenting is high. It's not just there was a that when there should have been a there or something, right? They're not like copy editing the story or something like that. But also because like there was a Washington Post story that came out the next day that clearly was a significant window into the special counsel's office, thinking was very well sourced, almost like as told to the Post by the special counsel's office. And that story made clear that this was intended to be broad critique or pushback of the story, not narrow pushback. It's not just a semantic detail here or there, right? It's calling into question the fundamental revelation / accusation, which said that Trump directed, and that was, I believe, BuzzFeed's word was directed Cohen to lie to Congress.
And also, I should say, BuzzFeed responded after the special counsel released that statement. They said, quote, as we've confirmed our reporting, we've seen no indication that any specific aspect of our story is inaccurate. We remain confident in what we've reported and will share more as we are able. So, Claire and Perry, how at this point do you view BuzzFeed's report? How should we view it?
I think it's still kind of a fluid situation. I mean, obviously Mueller's office doesn't often make statements pushing back, so we should take that with some grain of salt. On the other hand, I don't think you have to be entirely credulous of what their office says, that there might be something going on with BuzzFeed. Now, I think we should note that other outlets haven't been able to confirm this separately. Like often you'll see in these stories, the Post breaks it or the BuzzFeed breaks it, and then a couple of other news organizations follow with their own confirmations of the story. I have to admit, I am a little bit at odds to figure out what to make of this. And I don't think I'm alone. I mean, Perry, I'm interested to hear where you stand on this or where your thinking is at the moment.
I guess I would start with, you know, BuzzFeed is not the New York Times. It doesn't have that kind of reputation. But on Russia stories, they've actually done some good reporting. These reporters who did the story are sort of known for digging and being good. So I don't think people should dismiss it because it's BuzzFeed. I would say, I guess there are two things in the story. The story basically says Trump told Cohen to lie to Congress. and also that the special counsel has documents and knows this itself. And I wonder a little bit about whether part of the dispute here is about what the special counsel knows, as opposed to whether the accusation that Trump told Cohen to lie is true. Those are somewhat different facts. And a lot of the conjecture is this story may have emerged from the Southern District of New York's office, not the special counsel Mueller in Washington office. And that gets to sourcing, but also the Mueller people have been very intentional about not leaking. And this story did make it sound like they leaked. And I can see why in this case, it may be that the story was like so salacious because you had congressmen using the I word very aggressively on Friday. It was a big story, so I know they had to deny it based on that. But I do wonder if the special counsel's office got into this in part because the story kind of leaned on law enforcement officials said this thing happened with Mueller's office. So they probably had to say, no, it didn't happen to our office.
Right. I think this is actually like an interesting moment to talk to people a little bit about journalistic process, too, because I agree with Perry that probably the big pushback on this from the special counsel's office comes from that specific part of the story where they say it's, you know, based on like Cohen told Mueller's office something. The email that I believe Leopold of BuzzFeed sent to Mueller's spokesperson fact-checking was, I do think in retrospect, and this has been pointed out, I'm not casting aspersions on the reporting. I'm just saying like the email could have been more specific. I used to be a fact-checker for a magazine, and one of the premises of fact-checking newsy stuff like this is obviously for accuracy, but it's also to almost like control the burn before it's published. And I think that their note to they don't reporters notoriously don't get comment back from the special counsel's office. They often, you know, it's almost like pro forma, I think. So in some ways, I get why their email was vague. But I do think maybe this story would be different if it had been a bit more precise in its asking of the fact check.
And in the email, they just included the part about Donald Trump directing Michael Cohen to lie. They didn't include the part about what the special counsel's office had in terms of emails or other documents from the Trump organization.
But they did respond, right? Peter Carr, what's his name?
Yeah,
Peter Carr responded and said, we will decline to comment, right? So they did read that, and they're very precise. And so I don't know. Look,
but it didn't include – but I think the key thing is it didn't include a mention of their office, which obviously I think would have elicited perhaps, as we know now, a different response.
I mean, are we sure this hasn't been vetted and sourced in different – I mean, I don't know, right? So – one complication here is that Rudy Giuliani on, I forget which morning it is now, Sunday morning, I think, went on with Jake Tapper and appeared to take credit for encouraging the special counsel's office to reply in this way. So it could have been Giuliani says, well, you know, hey, Peter Carr, you know, you and I both know this isn't true or at least isn't proven. It's not doing my client any favors. It's not going to do you any favors. So there are false expectations about, like, what's going to come out of this testimony, what's going to come out of Mueller's report, and so why don't you go and correct the record?
So you're suggesting there could have been pressure on the special counsel's office.
I'm reading Empty Wheel, Marcy Wheeler, the way she transcribes and puts into context this, like, Rudy Giuliani kind of, I mean, it's Rudy, right? So he's kind of pontificating, and it's a little bit ambiguous just because he's not the most precise speaker, let's put it that way. But that seems like a plausible story and part of why it took almost 24, I think 22 or something hours to issue this pushback. And so again, to say that like this was strong pushback, that's not me saying there aren't other twists in the story. That's not even me saying it couldn't be true. Although remember, and something that Marcy Wheeler was saying, like, you know, Cohen's testimony to Congress said, yes, I lied about Trump Tower Moscow. And the reason I lied is because I was loyal to the president and I was trying to represent his interests, and that was my job. And so, of course, I was going to lie, right? He did not say that he was directed by Trump to lie. I guess it's not exclusive with him also feeling like he was going to lie anyway.
So I think, you know, this report is somewhat in limbo for the time being in terms of understanding what exactly did happen. But just to wrap up, Perry, I mean, do you think the media, including us, did the right thing in terms of, you know, the larger media ecosystem reporting on this report, talking about its implications, and just sort of including the caveat, if true?
This is a good and complicated question, because I was watching the CNN and MSNBC coverage, and I'll get to us in a second. But, you know, 538 itself does not have reporters covering the Russia story and day to day in this very aggressive way. But CNN and MSNBC do. And I thought it was a bit of a confusion to me. A lot of times these stories are able to be confirmed pretty quickly by the CNN, MSNBC, The Post, The Times. When the story couldn't be confirmed at all, I was a little nervous about what was happening. And I wonder almost like, I feel like one of the networks had the BuzzFeed reporters on TV. And it's a weird place to be in where you have reporters from other outlets saying, here's this news. If you have 10 reporters on a story and they can't confirm the news, it's worth thinking about if these outlets should feel so comfortable kind of leading with a story that their own very talented, CNN has very good reporters doing the Russia story. So I did wonder about if they should be more careful. I'm not criticizing them necessarily. I'm just thinking out loud here. Should they be more cautious about, you know, making sure their own reporters confirm something before they feature it heavily with the if true, because even though it's if true, more people probably learned about the story from CNN and MSNBC than on BuzzFeed's website.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point because, you know, I kind of kept on waiting for the Times story kind of summarizing what had happened, and it didn't come. And that's obviously a very conscious choice by them editorially to not do what the television networks did, which is sort of to implicitly promote the story by talking about it in their publication. I think it's a hard story for journalists because in some ways, if it's wrong, people feel the weight of, oh, shoot, like the media got something wrong, another reason to distrust the media, which is, I think that's overblown, but an unfortunate thing that could happen. I also think it's the dynamic of sort of what I mentioned before is that reporters aren't really trained to like be credulous of everything that a government entity says through a spokesperson. I mean, those people have their own motivations. I think obviously because Mueller has become such a cipher and that he never speaks, and when he does speak through his spokesman, it carries different weight. They obviously know that power. And so it's just kind of an odd dynamic, I think, for journalists. I think if you hear all of us talking and sort of like, we're treading a little lightly, at least speaking for myself, it's because I'm kind of not quite sure how to feel about this. And I think there's still a lot of ambiguity out there.
We will, of course, see what happens with this story. BuzzFeed sounds like they're going to continue reporting this out. They're standing by their reporting. We'll see what happens. But for now, let's move on to Kamala Harris's presidential bid. And before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by Joybird. There's a revolution going on in online furniture shopping. Anyone who's looked for furniture recently probably knows this. And Joybird is the company behind it all. From idea to reality, they empower you to create the space and furniture that brings you joy. As someone who recently furnished an apartment, I can tell you that being thoughtful about this stuff makes a big difference. With Joybird, you get one-of-a-kind furniture made to your unique taste, from mid-century modern to contemporary classics, customizable in an amazing array of fabric choices, from rich buttery leather and plush velvets to every color imaginable. Each Joybird piece is made by hand with care and precision, using high-quality hardwood and responsibly sourced materials to your exact specifications, with a limited lifetime warranty included. See how Joybird is revolutionizing online furniture shopping. Create the furniture that brings you joy today at joybird.com/538. That's joybird.com/538. And receive an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order by using the code 538. That's the numbers, not the letters. All right, this marks our fourth installment of The Theory of the Case, in which we talk about how each of the many, many Democrats who are running for president could win or lose the nomination. And before we jump into what exactly her path could look like, Perry, where does Harris fit into the party in terms of ideology and policy background?
I think she's generally where Hillary Clinton would be if she were running in this primary. What I mean by that is, like, she is... Harris is to the left on economic issues, but I don't think is quite to the left as a Bernie Sanders or Senator Warren. Harris is to the left on, we'll call them, identity issues, gay marriage, LGBT rights, immigration, things like that. I think of her as being maybe to the left of Sanders on kind of cultural issues and slightly to the right of Sanders on economic issues.
And are there any in particular policies that we can point to understand where she's coming from?
she was the 2017. She was the one of the first Democrats to say that the Democrats should have a shutdown if Trump did not extend DACA. Like, that was her sort of big stance. She's been in Congress in terms of saying, I'm trying to draw this sort of really left stance on immigration law. Obviously, that shutdown, if I remember, lasted like, you know, 2 or 3 days. But that was kind of the person she started from. I think further in her background, you're going to hear a lot of discussion about her record as attorney general and district attorney on criminal justice issues. And I think it looks like her record in California is more conservative than people thought and more than they would have expected. I don't think she'll campaign on that, but that those previous things will be a problem, I suspect.
It's interesting. If you look at Kamala Harris's DW nominate score, in the Senate, she is the second most liberal senator, second to Elizabeth Warren. Booker's third most liberal. Sanders is fifth most liberal. But Nate, Perry described her as maybe to the right of Sanders on economic issues. So how should we understand where exactly she falls within the party?
I mean, I think she's within the mainstream of the Democratic Party now, and the Democratic Party has moved to the left, right? So in some ways, she might be a good, you talk about the party decides, where there's a consensus of different factions of the party. You know, she might be a candidate who is acceptable to lots of different groups, and she will get, as Perry's piece points out, she will get pushback on the left. I tend to think that the left is going to give pushback against any candidate who's not Bernie Sanders and maybe Elizabeth Warren. We can talk about that later, maybe. But I think she's someone who will, like a lot of presidential candidates, try and have it both ways a little bit. On the one hand, you want to tell the kind of party establishment wing that, hey, look, I'm electable and I do have a couple of conservative stripes in my record. Maybe it's not the worst thing, right? On the other hand, you want to like win a primary where more and more Democrats identify as not just liberal but left and make sure she appeals to voters that might originally have wanted to vote for Bernie Sanders, because that's 20-something percent of the electorate.
Yeah, she's a really interesting candidate. I think to her advantage is the fact that she's a pretty new character on the national political scene. She's only been a senator for 2 years. You know, and when she came up nationally, she received a lot of favorable comparisons to Obama because she was a rising star in a big Democratic state who was black. Obama mentioned her a lot. She, as Perry pointed out, was an early supporter of Obama when it wasn't a popular thing to do. You know, everything we've said about she has pretty left politics, she could get pushback from the left as a prosecutor, that's all true. I think the one interesting thing about Harris to me when we talk about the argument of, you know, she was too conservative as a prosecutor, I mean, a couple things. The dynamics of California as a state, they're actually a bit conservative as a state on crime, on criminal justice stuff. So part of me wonders if she wasn't in some ways responding to the internal politics of her state. The other thing, and this gets into the challenges that Harris could face, is, you know, I think in some ways she's in this bind because she was a black woman who was coming up through pretty establishment halls of power. And I think that resume gives her and gave her a certain cachet and credibility that might not have been as readily available to her if she were a more liberal, you know, Berkeley type, however you want to put it, during her earlier days in Democratic politics. I mean, I do think we need to remember how, you know, she's 54. I mean, she came up during different decades in how we think about racial politics in America, even on the left. So I think Harris has the obviously interesting and potentially challenging intersection of she's a woman and she is a black woman. And it's a time in American history where both those things, both those identities within American politics can be tricky.
Okay, so let's take a step back and look at what exactly her path would look like to winning the nomination. Perry, you wrote the article about the theory of her case for the website. What are the arguments for why she'll win the nomination?
You know, Obama definitely won the black vote overwhelmingly, and that helped a lot. Hillary did, too, in 2016. I mentioned Obama first in part because his positioning on kind of his coalition was always a little bit, you know, he did a lot of Iowa. He wanted to avoid being the black candidate in a lot of ways. Like, Harris's real, you know, made sure to mention Howard University yesterday. She had a press conference there. Her first real event's going to be Friday. She's going to speak in South Carolina at a convention of AKAs, which is her sorority, which is a black sorority she was associated with and was a member of. So she's really kind of, I don't know, I use the phrase, I hate the phrase leaning in, but she really is going to, I think, try to kind of be the candidate for the black electorate first, or like sort of win that sort of mini primary with Cory Booker, I guess, and then sort of go from there. I'm being a little bit silly about that, but I think there is a sense that she's going to try to, you know, the black vote is important. She's clearly aiming at that, along with, I think her record suggests she could win a lot of people who are sort of more party establishment, people who like Hillary, you know, like the kind of person who likes like a Stacey Abrams, which is both black and white and non-black and non-white, but a person who's like a party person, but is a woman, suburban perhaps, you know, who likes that kind of Democrat, I think is where she goes in terms of her voters. I don't think she'll do well with the sort of most left, most Bernie Sanders people, as Nate said. And then in terms of the nomination process itself, I think you have to do well in Iowa, New Hampshire, but I think she'll, you know, where her strength would be is Nevada is a state that has somewhat similar politics and demographics to California. South Carolina has a very big black vote. And then on March 3rd, you have this big sort of mega primary day where you have California, you have Texas, and you have four states that are in the South that have a lot of big black populations. And I think the March 3rd day, if she's doing well, could be a very, very big day for her.
The fact that California and Texas moved up to March 3rd, I mean, does that change the whole Democratic primary in a sense, Nate?
It's partly up to us. It's partly up to us, the media, in terms of what we think is most important. It's up to the voters. It's up to the candidate. So it's a little bit open-ended. I mean, I agree with Perry that, like, overall, if you say which candidate benefits the most from the calendar, then I think Harris might be the first answer to that. Although, I don't know that Iowa or New Hampshire are great states for her. But
and is that just
South
because
Carolina,
they're so white?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. They're really white.
He's also, I think, a left element too for in Iowa.
That's right. Yeah, and they're different kinds of left, right? I mean, you can imagine, but you know, they're going to be candidates who camp out in Iowa for months and months and months. But she's not from the Midwest, right? She definitely does not seem like the type of candidate a New Hampshire lefty Democrat would like. And there are going to be multiple candidates from New England probably in the race, but every other state, you know, Perry mentioned that Nevada is close and has a lot of close ties to California. South Carolina, large African-American population, California, you have Virginia, and I believe North Carolina in that first batch of states. You know, Virginia's a good state for Kamala Harris, maybe. Texas, you have Beto and Castro, which would be a little bit of a challenge. But overall, by the way, if you want to get really into detail here, so Democrats have a rule that you have to get at least 15% of the vote to qualify for delegates, which in the later stages, it wouldn't matter if you're down to two or three candidates. People always get 15%. However, if you're in California and you have early voting taking place in February when the field still has 11 or 12 candidates, right? You can imagine Kamala Harris getting, say, 28% of the vote. And I don't know who else. You know, Elizabeth Warren gets 16%. And everyone else falls below that 15% threshold. And then all of a sudden,
they get all the
Harris
delegates.
And Warren get a ton of delegates. There are some complications. It's actually done partly by congressional district. But that notwithstanding, if she were to have a big headway from California, then that could affect the math quite a bit the rest of the way forward.
Perry mentioned she could, in some ways, maybe put together a Hillary Clinton-style coalition. Post the 2016 election, that may not necessarily sound like a compliment. I don't know. Do you see that as a strength?
Yeah, no, I think the Clinton coalition is underrated in some ways because she won that primary by a pretty clear margin at the end of the day. And in part because, you know, my view is that political commentators underweight the importance of non-white voters, right? Where it's almost like, you know, the reason Trump, for example, is at a 40% approval rating is in part, despite this weird Marist poll he tweeted about, which we can talk about some other time on bad use of polling, is because non-white voters overwhelmingly dislike the president. And the Democratic electorate, non-white voters are 40% of the electorate, and I think they tend to be discounted. And so Hillary Clinton basically, did she lose the white vote to Bernie Sanders? Might have been pretty close, right? But if you're winning 70 or 80% of the black vote, if you're winning 70-ish, that declined in some late primaries, the Hispanic vote, 70% of the Asian vote, I don't know who won Native Americans offhand, but like that's a lot of voters, and you have to, you know, that really adds up. You know, Harris might have trouble on the leftmost part of the party. She might also have trouble on the rightmost part of the party. I mean, she's certainly not a moderate. I think you certainly will see some of the discourse about electability. A lot of that discourse turns on ideas about, hey, can a black/Asian woman be elected in America and Donald Trump's America, never minding that Barack Obama was elected just 4 years before Trump was elected, or reelected, rather. So I think, you know, she's not going to necessarily have a lot of appeal like the Joe Biden constituency in the party. But in some ways, that leaves her well situated to be a survivor, because she's someone who could both tolerate a candidate on the left hanging around there and a candidate to her right. She can kind of pivot off either one, or maybe both potentially, which might not be a bad situation for her when she starts to win by plurality. The fact that you have California going early, I mean, if she blows it in California, then okay, right? And they're going to be, we're going to talk about however many candidates, 15 candidates, of whom, let's say, 10 are serious ones. She's one of the serious ones. Of the 10 candidates, there are going to be a few, bless his heart, but a few Marco Rubios in the bunch. They're going to be people that look great on paper, that just don't our former favorite, don't market test well, that like are flops in the debates, are flops in terms of like on the stump, who don't manage media expectations well, whatever else. And maybe she'll be one of them, I don't know, but she has things nicely set up with where she is situated within the party, especially given the order of states.
Yeah, can I just say just one really quick recent election that we should think about when we think about Kamala Harris and sort of the coalition she's trying to win? I mean, Stacey Abrams, who came very close in Georgia. Yes, I think a lot of her appeal was about turning out minority voters, but also it was appealing to kind of the new swing voters. Or, you know, her proposition was also, I can win white people. I can win those white suburban women. And I think that's a powerful election to go back and look at. I mean, I think Abrams faced a lot of kind of sketchiness vis-a-vis the voter rolls in Georgia, and that election was incredibly close. So I think if you're looking at that constituency in the Democratic Party, the kind of people who voted for Stacey Abrams might also vote for Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't get nearly as much credit as Beto O'Rourke, but she certainly outperformed the baseline in Georgia.
And it's an interesting question why she doesn't get a lot of attention.
Yeah. So, Perry, Nate started to talk about it a little bit, but what is the case for, you know, why she won't win the nomination?
The thing I think is most important here is I just think that not only can, you know, you never know who's going to be the next Marco Rubio, and any of these people could be, but I really think with her, and maybe this is something I perceive from talking to people about her. One thing is I've heard people say, I went to her speech and she wasn't as good as Obama. I really think her and Booker are going to suffer from the, I saw the real thing and they weren't quite the real thing. And that is definitely identity based. And so but it is what it is. Like, Warren may benefit from the fact that compared to Hillary Clinton, she may be more charismatic than Hillary Clinton, even though they're both white women of a certain age. And I do think Harris is going to have a little bit of the, I thought this was going to be the greatest thing ever. And it's not, you know, Democrats love Obama. And I think that's a hard comparison for anybody. I think Booker and Harris will get a lot of that. Electability, I think, is something that is just in the water right now. I just think that is something. And just, again, I think it's people's perception is black woman, you know, multiracial, you know, biracial woman means Iowa swing voters won't like that person. Obama just won, but Hillary just lost. I just think it's in people's heads, and it's something that's going to be a real thing, particularly if you're a kind of a moderate person anyway, then like the Joe Biden appeal is Joe Biden may be more ideologically with you. And also he looks like he can win. Maybe if you really like Beto, and there's a lot of things I like about Beto, I think that you could see people thinking, I like Beto and I like Kamala. Seems like Beto might do better in Wisconsin because he's a white man. I think those things are important here. And I do think the left thing will make some of a difference, because there's a lot of candidates in this kind of left lane, from Gillibrand to Castro to Booker to Warren to Sanders. The left lane is probably bigger, but it may actually be easier. The vice president may, if he runs, may benefit from the fact that, you know, I think if Biden runs, that sort of breaks out McAuliffe and Hickenlooper, and all those people might not run. Biden may have a clearer lane. I think Harris is in a very crowded lane with a bunch of women candidates, another prominent black candidate, a lot of people with similar politics to her.
just to go back a little bit to what you were talking about in terms of electability, I'll let listeners know that we actually had a longer conversation between you and Julia Azari back in August on this podcast. That episode's called What Does It Mean to Be Electable? But what do we actually know about electability? When people say, oh, you know, I like Beto O'Rourke and I like Kamala Harris, but I think Beto O'Rourke is more electable in Wisconsin. Do we have good data to back that up?
I mean, obviously, I want to defer here a bit to the expert on data and so on. So I want to hear what he thinks, too. But my I did a piece about this, and the analysis about female candidates is pretty comprehensive at this point. And female candidates overall do not do worse. And this has been tested in, at least in congressional races, and I know presidents different, but in congressional races, governor's races, female candidates do not do worse. There's more limited evidence about Black and Latino candidates, but the evidence so far suggests that Black and Latino candidates do a little less good with white voters, but they also tend to turn out Black and Latino voters more, Black voters for Black candidates, Latino voters for Latino candidates. You can imagine, you know, Obama wins Michigan because he gets a higher Black turnout, and that's kind of how that could work. But that's kind of my understanding of the general research of it, is it's complicated, but women candidates are not doing worse. 2016, you can think about, but that's kind of the research overall.
I think you'd have to go on a candidate by candidate basis. Obviously, we had an African American elected president. Look, what Beto, and for that matter, Stacey Abrams, could say is that we overperformed relative to the partisanship of our states. Harris can't really say that. One problem is that in her most recent election to the Senate, you actually had a Democrat versus Democrat election because she and Loretta Sanchez, Congresswoman, were the top two finishers, so that's hard to judge. But, like, you know, she barely won the attorney general's race in 2010. She was reelected by 15 points in 2014, which is good, given that 2014 was a very Republican year, but not fantastic because it is California. And so she doesn't have that argument. She also is at about 4 or 5% in average of polls of primary voters right now, which is not super high. It's obviously not 1 or 2% like Gillibrand or someone's at, so it's something to work with. And she does better among voters who are more informed about the process, and we'll see now that she's declared, will that number go up? But, like, you know, look, you kind of can't have it both ways. On the one hand, she's very well positioned because she can appeal to almost every constituency within the party. On the other hand, as Perry is saying, that means you have a lot of competition on multiple fronts for multiple candidates, and she has a bit of the risk of being a lot of people's second choice. And we have not winner-take-all primaries, but you one vote per candidate, right? It's not ranked choice voting or something. And so if you're a lot of people's second choice, then that's not great for delegate accumulation. Although, again, it does help her a lot to have California go early. I really think, like, you know, I think we would say in general that usually the system doesn't matter that much and it's about who the candidates are. But in this case, it seems like a important factor in the process.
All right. Right now, we are going to turn to how the left feels about capitalism and what activists are doing to try to change our system. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by SimpliSafe. Here's a timely statistic for you. Almost half of us make a New Year's resolution every single year. We've all made them, and most of us have probably broken them. Happens to the best of us. But one resolution worth sticking to this year is keeping your home and family safe with SimpliSafe Home Security. SimpliSafe is 24/7 home security with no contracts or catches. They believe the safest place on earth should be your own home, so you feel protected every time you shut your door and leave for work or shut your eyes at night. More than 3 million people feel this way every day thanks to SimpliSafe. 2019 feels like a good year to ask yourself, is my home the safest it could be? And if you're thinking, well, maybe this is the year to change that. Get SimpliSafe. Go to simplisafe.com/politics to get started. That's SimpliSafe, SimpliSafe, SAFE.com/politics to protect your home and family today. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Upstart. Applying for a loan is a lot like applying for a job that you don't get to interview for. Instead, loan companies make their decisions based off of your credit score and history without getting to know the whole you. Now, thanks to Upstart.com, it never has to be that way again. Upstart is revolutionizing the way you borrow money by rewarding you for your job experience and education in the form of a smarter interest rate. Unlike traditional credit underwriting, which would be biased against people with a short credit history, Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. Free yourself from the burden of high-interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. Hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes 2 minutes, and it won't affect your credit. That's Upstart, upstart.com/politics. Over the coming year or so, we're going to hear plenty about visions for the Democratic Party and for the country as a whole from presidential contenders and activists. And criticism of capitalism is likely to be a part of that. In 2016, more Democrats approved of socialism than capitalism for the first time, according to Gallup, since they started asking that question. And the trend continued in 2018. Claire did some fantastic reporting on this in a piece out today called The Young Left's Anti-Capitalist Manifesto. So, Claire, who is the Young Left, and how much of a force are they in the Democratic Party?
Great question, Galen. Well, I think they're a big force in the Democratic Party, to reverse answer this. One of the reasons why I wanted to do this story is because I've noticed how much policies that were considered too far left in the 2016 primary have become very mainstream, almost litmus tests for people who are running in 2020, how these ideas about abolishing ICE picked up steam and enthusiasm in the past year. And these are things that I think wouldn't have gotten as much attention even 2 years ago among the same people on the left. And so I kind of wanted to look into why that was. And, you know, a lot of the Young Left, I think we can describe them as, they're not necessarily all Bernie Sanders alumni, although many of them are, but they're generally young people who, while they might vote Democratic, they don't necessarily like the Democratic Party establishment that they see. A lot of them came of political age in the decade following the financial crash, so they don't have the same kind of reverence for capitalism or, you know, the American capitalist marketplace that their parents or, you know, people a couple years older might have. They were really shaped by the financial crisis. And I wanted to write not just about the, you know, the top line Twitter memes, but just about this real fundamental, I think, shift in the way they see the world, which is they don't think capitalism is the best way. They don't necessarily think we should totally get rid of it, but they think it needs to be amended. And I think that that is a real and radical change in American political discourse. And I wanted to talk to some of the people who are behind, you know, certainly the campaigns of people like Ocasio-Cortez, but just people who are trying to move state laws in a more left progressive direction. And so that's kind of it. It's about the activists sort of behind that movement.
It sounds like there's a lot of things that they want, but if you had to summarize a little bit, it's not necessarily all based on dismantling capitalism or abolishing ICE. What's the general package of policies that they're pushing for?
Well, I would say that if people hear about something called the Green New Deal,
yes,
either now or going forward in the next year, it is largely becoming popularized, I think, because of the work of some of these activists who kind of say, okay, you know, environmentalism is, you know, environmental dangers are one of the biggest challenges. Also, people need jobs. Let's institute sort of FDR-esque massive, you know, jobs training programs. Let's really make people inspired by government again. In some ways, I think a lot of these people on the left want this to be kind of like a nouveau New Deal kind of thing. And so the Green New Deal is kind of their marquee policy. And so that's, I think that's probably the one to pay attention to, and to pay attention to presidential candidates and whether or not they adopt that proposal.
Perry and Nate, I'm curious, how does this part of the Democratic Party or the left, if they don't consider themselves part of the Democratic Party, how does it compare to past insurgencies within the parties or movements or activists?
I mean, kind of infamously, you've had the baby boomers in charge of the party for a long time, and this is turnover, I guess, right? The baby boomers had a good run, and
did they?
Well, they had a long run. They had a long run, Galen.
Well, this new movement it's sharper elbowed. They're taking swings and bites at the boomers.
I think it's been a long time since we had a broad, kind of openly and proudly leftist movement that was trying to operate within existing party infrastructures, within the Democratic Party infrastructure in particular, instead of on the outside. Although there is a bit of tension, I would think, between people on the left who say the Democratic Party is a rotting corpse, I want nothing to do with it, versus people who are more pragmatic. I think the people interviewed in Claire's piece are the more pragmatic side. They say, look, we have two major parties in America. It's not going to change. And our best hope is to make this liberal-ish center-left party into a real left party. And we're going to work within the system kind of smartly and provocatively. And so I don't know. You know, I think it's having covered politics, I think one of the more impressive things I've seen was the big split between Clinton and Bernie Sanders among voters roughly 35 and younger in 2016. That really felt like it was generational in nature, and partly left-right politics, but also partly in terms of like what type of story do you tell about how you find success in America. If you were not born remembering the Cold War, then you're going to have different views. If you remember like the financial crisis, but not the Cold War, for example, that's going to affect your views of capitalism versus communism and everything else. And you think of like now socialism is like, again, like it's Sweden or Denmark where everyone is tall and blonde and rich and they have weird food, but like, and it's cold, but like everyone's happy and things work well and has a high standard of living. You know, it's different than kind of growing up and thinking, hey, communism
is starving people
was the enemy.
Yeah.
And socialism was 2/3 of the way to communism, and it's kind of how you're taught growing up if you're 41 like I am or something, right? And so,
ooh, dropping the age.
But I actually think it's a very significant thing. I'm a little bit younger than Nate, and I think I am at the exact right age to bridge the generational gaps, which is to say I'm older. I remember the crash happening very well, but I also saw the disillusionment that followed it. And I just want, I mean, I think what this really comes down to is this is, for a long time, I think people have snorted a little bit at the idea of the millennial generation. And in some ways, this is the millennials sort of coming to power in a real political way. And the fact that they're doing it in a way that, you know, some of the pieces is about the stylistic ways that these activists are going after the Democratic establishment, that they want to, you know, jump the line a little bit, that they want to really upset the apple cart. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that they just don't believe in the system at all. There's just a real almost gap between it. Almost it goes from the boomers being in power to the millennials being in power.
Sorry, Gen X.
Yeah, no, but it's interesting to watch that kind of. This is not, spare me, Gen Xers, your angry letters. There are obviously people who are even running for president or probably will run for president who are Gen X. But I think it's that this is kind of the political actualization of millennials on the left and the kind of unique form it has taken.
Perry, you spent a lot of time reporting in Washington. I mean, what kind of effect do you see these activists having on the establishment?
A ton of it. I mean, we did this chat last week about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and how, you know, you can tell it's not just that the Republicans are obsessed and nervous about her, but the Democratic members are very obsessed and kind of nervous about her in the sense that they feel like she's accruing power and the people who've been there a long time haven't. And that gets to the fact that they feel like she represents something they don't totally understand. I want to jump back a little bit about what they believe, though. I thought there was a great moment yesterday. Ta-Nehisi Coates asked Ocasio-Cortez, do you think it's moral to be a billionaire, something to that effect? And she said no. And I think that's a good illustration of like where the activist kind of left is. When I think about them, I sort of think about, and I think Claire's piece got into this a little bit, a lot of their economic views are probably close to Bernie Sanders, but Bernie Sanders on sort of like racial issues, it took him a while to kind of move left on those too, versus I think a lot of these activists, they were pushing abolish ICE. They kind of have the like Black Lives Matter platform views on racial issues, which is pretty radical and pretty left of the Democratic Party. In terms of historical analogy, I thought a little bit about the kind of Gingrich Republicans of the early 80s in terms of like being aggressive in tactics, changing the party. Thought about a little bit about the DLC, actually, which moved the Democratic Party to the right, but it definitely had this kind of the party elites are getting it wrong, we need to get it right element. Claire sort of mentioned the Tea Party in her piece, and I think some of the people there mentioned that. I think the Tea Party is the obvious analogy, except the Tea Party is kind of anti-government a certain way, and the activist left, of course, wants the government to do much more. But I think there is a element in those. There's definitely historical analogies to a group of activists who think the party really needs to move aggressively in one direction and kind of starts from ideas and then moves to primaries for Congress. And now you can tell they're moving into the 2020 process. I think Warren and Booker, no one's really written the Green New Deal bill yet. But already Warren and Booker have said, I'm for something called the Green New Deal, because they know they have to be.
Yeah, I mean, to the Tea Party of the Left point, I think one of the people that I talked to in the piece sort of had a different analogy, which was, he said, we're more like Thaddeus Stevens and the radical Republicans pushing Lincoln to be an actually abolitionist president. And you see Ocasio-Cortez using sort of similar language, saying, listen, FDR had the labor unions pushing him on the New Deal. LBJ had civil rights activists pushing him. We are the people who are, you know, the new pushers of this generation. And I think, you know, the one thing is, a lot of these, you know, the Green New Deal, it's still a vague thing as far as policy proposals go. I think you're probably going to see a lot of these candidates in 2020, regardless of whether or not they specifically say, yeah, we're for, you know, Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal plan. They're certainly going to be adapting that rhetoric of environmentalism attached to an economic overhaul. But they very willingly, I think, accept the mantle of, we are the Tea Party of the Left.
On that topic, one of the activists that you talked to considered himself an Overton window mover, which is, you know, essentially meaning that he wants to move the outer bounds of what's considered publicly acceptable. Mm-hmm. In a way, that's what the Tea Party did. They pushed for things like, well, repealing the ACA, but also abolishing the IRS, phasing out Social Security and Medicare for private investment accounts, raising the retirement age, instituting a flat income tax, like the list goes on. However, so those became popular to talk about, ranging from 2010 to, say, 2016. But if you look at what was actually accomplished on a policy level, like not even repealing the ACA.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things I think that has emerged post-2016 in the Democratic Party, and Hillary Clinton sort of admitted this or acknowledged this in her book, is that people on the left almost seem to say, we need to think more about our self-presentation and our sort of sloganeering. You know, Clinton criticized Sanders for having policy ideas, she said, that sounded pretty but weren't actually something you could put into effect. I think sort of the project of this young left is almost, I mean, I talk about it as exposure therapy for the Democratic establishment to these new ideas, these sort of Sanders-esque ideas, and kind of moving them into the realm of the possible, or at the very least, if we're being really cynical, promoting ideas that sound good to people during elections that will make them elect left candidates, and then those candidates might make some headway as far as policies go. Maybe they won't live up to the poetry of their campaigns, but they'll, you know, shift things marginally left. But I do think it's, I think what we're seeing is, in some ways, the reason why this group has risen to prominence has a lot to do with the fact that the Democrats lost to Donald Trump, and that there was a lot of derision for whether or not, on the left, whether or not Bernie Sanders' ideas were actually practical and could actually be put into effect. And then America elected a president who said, you know, we're going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it. Well, I don't know if people have been keeping track, but we really dropped the Mexico pay for it thing a long time ago, and it might not be a wall and blah, blah, blah. All of this is to say, maybe politicians don't necessarily do the things that they say they're going to do once they get into office, but there's maybe more of a willingness, and you can think this is moral or immoral, to say things that will make the electorate get excited. Whether or not you can actually accomplish them once you're in office, you know, that's another question. But that's a little bit of what's happening here.
I think the Overton window concept, while being over-discussed at this point, is actually broadly correct, is that the Tea Party made, you know, by saying we must repeal all of Obamacare, that did sound like an extreme, unrealistic idea. But if you look at what's happened in terms of Obamacare, you know, a huge swath of states, the entire South, will not expand Medicaid. You know, the Trump administration will not allow, you know, not help anyone enroll in Obamacare. They got rid of the mandate. It's not that Obamacare has been repealed, but I think a third of it isn't working very well, at least, maybe more than that. It's definitely making, like, you know, repeal the goal has made these aggressive moves to limit it, you know, seem more normal and seem almost required if you're a Republican politician. Similarly, I don't know if, like, Joe Biden will say he's for Medicare for all in 2020. My guess is he'll say I'm for a Medicare buy-in option or something like that. But even then, that's moved the window. And if Elizabeth Warren is president or Kamala Harris or someone who's more liberal, they'll have to at least pretend to push for Medicare for all before they sign on to the, you know, Medicare option, people who something smaller. I do think this window moving, like, I don't think most of the candidates will end up being with abolish ICE, but they'll have something like, I will drastically reduce the number of ICE agents, change how ICE operates, and so on. So I think, you know, I think Sean is the person with this who's most expressed this idea, and I think it's probably a pretty smart one. But I think the idea of radical ideas by the base leads to politicians feeling accountable to doing somewhat radical things is probably right.
In some ways, I think the overtime window strategy, if you will, reflects a fairly correct understanding of how the media works, which is the media wants to frame things on a relative basis. They try not to, like, actually evaluate the underlying veracity of the claims. So if you say 11 and the other side says 1, then they'll say, okay, the middle is 6, you know. If you say 100 and the other side says 1, they say, oh, the middle is 50. I mean, obviously, it's like a very, very gross oversimplification of it, but there is some degree of truth there. You know, I think empirically it tends to work more often than not to try and kind of shift the windows of the debate a little bit. You know, there are times when there might be a backlash to it. Like, if someone's negotiating with me about something and they make, like, a transparently ridiculous offer, right, then that can cost them credibility. So be like, oh, well, F you, right? You know, I know you're not serious and you demonstrate how unserious you are, so I'm walking away from the table, right? And so maybe if you play the Overton window card too often, then it eventually backfires, and kind of the game theoretically correct response. I'm thinking too much about, like, poker and stuff, right? but, you know, it's also the case, though, that, like, with the big exception of abolish ICE, which is not popular or even that close to popular, some positions that the left takes are popular. So Ocasio-Cortez's 70% marginal tax rate, someone polled that, and it was actually more popular than not. It was not a great poll, but, like, I think the Harris poll had, like, 55% in a favor, 45% opposed to it or something, right? And so sometimes the discourse that takes place in Washington is among people that share certain values, that tilt toward values that are held by older rather than younger people, are held by wealthier rather than poorer people, whiter rather than non-whiter people, right? And so sometimes what's seen as radical actually isn't that radical relative to where the entire population might line up.
I think, and there's, you know, a couple of the people I talked to sort of expressed similar sentiments. You know, one person said, this is a moment that has electoralized radicals and radicalized, you know, sort of the mainstream people. Another person said, politics is still the art of the compromise, but the idea is on whose terms is the compromise, right? So it is all about, yeah, we might not get exactly what we want, but, you know, what are we doing to get people in the process to kind of hammer it out?
All right. Well, I guess we will see whether or not they get people in the process to hammer things out in there the way they want them to.
I just want a Gen X president to bring this back to generation.
Do you feel left out as a Gen Xer?
I mean, I think this is actually, like, literally,
oh my God.
This is, like, part of the appeal of Beto. He's so Gen X-y. Right.
I mean, I guess. I guess you're speaking for you. I don't know.
You guys are, Perry's Gen X, right? I'm not allowed to, like,
I'm
guess my
38.
College.
I think I'm very similar. I think.
Oh, said, yeah.
Is 38 Gen X or
that's close.
It's close, though.
The cutoff is 1980. If you were born in 1980, you're technically a millennial.
So I've read 1881. I'm born in 80, so we can, yes.
Yeah. So you're cuspy.
All right. Welcome to the club, Perry. And with that, we're going to wrap up. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store. When you leave a rating, it helps our rankings, which helps others discover the show. Or tell someone about us. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.